Well, good evening and welcome to this live stream event on the 22nd of June 2021. Great to have you all on board. And it is a pretty important show, actually, a lot to talk about because of where the markets are and where they are perhaps likely to go. As with all of these things, no one's quite sure precisely how these things are going to play out, but you know, I think we are at an interesting inflection point, and I'll try and share some of that data shortly to highlight some of the issues. Just a couple of things I want to cover off first. By way of this introduction, we, of course, go through our introduction, which is we're doing this house rules. I'll cover the models just very briefly tonight, but I really want to talk about some key data that we're going to run through. And then we'll have questions and answers. The bulk of the conversations will be what you want to talk about, really. So feel free to ask questions as we go. And in terms of the house rules, and just to remind everybody, this isn't financial advice. We don't give financial advice on this channel. This is very much just a question of, you know, opinions. Yeah, sure. Some analysis, sure, but it's not financial advice. If you need financial advice, go find a financial advisor. Secondly, do play nice in the chat room. No racial slurs, please. We do moderate the stream, and we have dropped a few people off. We don't like to do that. We do encourage everybody to share their views and opinions and chat in the chat, but no racial slurs, please. And this is as at the 22nd of June 2021. I have got the date right today. Good. And use that Walk the World to get my attention. There's always a lot going on in the chat, and this is a way of making sure that I see them. There is also Super Chat enabled. Wayne's already used it. Thanks, Wayne. And if anybody wants to make a contribution to help us with the shows, then Super Chat is a way to do that. Or if you want to get your question to the top of the list, again, Super Chat enables you to do that too. Now, just to talk a little bit about Tony Lecandro. Tony was due to come on tonight, and up until this morning we were expecting him, but unfortunately he's had some family emergencies that required his attention today. So, Tony, our thoughts are with you. We're missing you. We were going to play Lecandro Bingo, of course, with all of the sandpaper to death and all of those sorts of things. But anyway, Tony, we're wishing you the best with everything you're dealing with at the moment. I know it's a bit of a chaotic time for you, and hopefully you'll come back on in a future show. Looking forward to that. Just also while I'm on, just to mention the DFA one-to-ones, we are still providing this service, got quite a few in the pipeline at the moment, and that allows us to have a chat about a particular suburb. So if you want to have a one-to-one conversation about a specific suburb, not financial advice, but I can talk about the underlying trends, the stress and those sorts of things based on my modelling. And you can also book a time about for an hour or so via Zoom or a phone discussion. And there is a cost involved. That's to cover the cost of the research. It takes about a day to do the research. And typically 3 to 5 weeks out, simply because there's so much going on at the moment. So many people want advice about what's going on. Can't give specific advice, but I can share my data. And of course, that data comes from my core market models, which are essentially my surveys and other things. And now let me come back to this slide. This is from the Reserve Bank. So what I want to do over the next few moments is just to paint a few pictures and try and give you a bit of a sense of some of the things that I'm looking at the moment to try and get a read on where our economy is and where the global economy is and where the financial markets are. Because the critical question when you come to thinking about investing is what is going on contextually speaking. Now, for example, the RBA presentation from Lowe recently made the point that our employment, the change of employment in Australia is a lot stronger than many other countries, and our GDP growth is also a lot stronger. So, superficially at least, you might argue that, in fact, things are looking pretty good at the moment. That's what the RBA says anyway. But savings ratio, of course, is falling now. It went up very high, up to more than 20%. It's now dropping, and that's because we're spending a lot more than we were spending previously. We were saving last year when we couldn't spend. Now we're spending a lot more. That's one of the reasons why the stress data is actually rising. So as more people drain their savings, it means that they've got less reserves, and that creates issues later. So watch that savings ratio. If it continues to fall, as I expect it will fall, that's going to be a very significant event, in my view, as things move forward. We'll see how quickly it drops, but it is moving back very smartly. And remember, of course, the base effect, because, of course, there's a big run up, so we're going to see a big run down as well. Now, another rather interesting piece of information is this. The wage price index is showing, well, not a lot really, and this is from the Reserve Bank. The wage price index increased by just 1.5% over the past year. Wage growth slow in the private and public sectors. It's noteworthy they said that even in these pockets where firms are finding it hardest to hire workers, wage increases are mostly modest. There are some exceptions to this, but they are fairly isolated. In other words, no wages growth for you anytime soon. And that's a very important indicator of whether inflation driven from specifically wages is likely to come through. My own view at the moment is there's very little evidence that that's going to be the case. And whilst there might be inflation in some asset prices and some other costs, no inflation in wages for any time soon is what I'm reading into that. That's quite important, of course, because if that does change, then that would be a significant turnaround as we saw in the 70s and the 80s. But the other interesting question is, what is the real number when it comes to unemployment? Because there are actually a number of different data points out there. Of course, the ABS data came out at 5.1, and they said, oh, this is a reasonably, really, really good number. Remember, of course, the base effect is still there, 5.1%. But the Roy Morgan number came out with a very different number. This is actually a slightly mismatched in terms of timing, but essentially Roy Morgan is talking about 10% and the underemployment and unemployed at 18.9%. And the other factor to bear in mind is that the non-residential workers dropped dramatically. So what that means is there's around 330 people now working in Australia doing jobs that were previously done by non-residential workers. But interestingly, non-residential workers are not included in the core employment numbers. So what that actually means is that the true unemployment number, if you calculate on the previous basis, is closer to 7% rather than 5%. So I think we need to be cautious about claiming victory when it comes to unemployment. And interestingly, a lot of the lower levels of unemployment are actually in regional areas where a lot of the non-residential workers would have been doing the work previously, whereas now what it means is that that work is being done by locals. So we're not necessarily comparing before and after. And in fact, Roy Morgan makes a very interesting point with regard to this. They're basically saying that if you compare today with early March 2020, there are nearly 600,000 more Australians either unemployed or underemployed. That's up 3.3 percentage points, even though the overall employment number is now higher than it was pre-COVID, right? So we have to be really careful about the politician's spin here, where they claim that the economy is booming and everything's wonderful. 600,000 more people, 600,000 more with either less work or no work, that is a really big deal. And I think, you know, we should put that in context. It's also worth noting that the Roy Morgan data says that unemployment is now lowest in New South Wales, down 1.9 points. The other states didn't drop as far. And in fact, they also make the point, very interestingly, of course, that New South Wales and Victoria took the bulk of JobKeeper, the $89 billion JobKeeper wage subsidy, with $30 billion, or 33%, handed to New South Wales, and $28.1 billion, 31.7% delivered to Victoria. Now, of course, there's no surprise at one level, because they're the biggest states, but nevertheless, it is interesting to see that distribution. And it's interesting how unemployment increased in the smaller states in May, and was up in Western Australia at 11.7%, up 3.7 points, South Australia at 12%, and Tasmania at 11.7%. And they do make the point that part of this is to do with part-time employment. And that's something else that we should bear in mind when we think about all of this data, the difference between full-time and part-time work, because it's not the same, of course. And one of the things that I keep observing in my surveys is that more people have more part-time work, multiple jobs, than previously. And that takes us to the underemployment discussion. This is from the Reserve Bank. So the RBA defines an underemployed person as someone who is currently employed but would like to and is available to work additional hours. So you could have more than one job. There still could be a shortfall in terms of preferred hours. And it represents spare capacity in the economy. And they said that over the last 40 years, the share of part-time employment has roughly doubled from around 15% to around one-third at present. And the rise in part-time employment has been a key driver of longer-term increases in underemployment rates. Now, that is sort of partly true. But again, my surveys highlight that a lot of people don't want to be underemployed. They're actually forced into multiple part-time jobs simply because there's no other option. They can't find a full-time job. And it's also interesting, if you look at the wages that are coming through, the multiple part-time jobs total up the total wages that they're actually getting. It's a lot lower than it would be if they were in full-time employment. So there is a direct correlation, in my view, between underemployment and low wages. And that's something which I think that the Reserve Bank is underestimating in terms of the economic impacts on what's going on at the moment. There's another interesting factor that's worth reflecting on too, and that is that the changes to this underemployment rate is actually quite significant. It does vary by industry. So accommodation and food has the high share of part-time workers and also the highest underemployment ratio. And you can see there that the changes in underemployment, that's the one on the left-hand side, is pretty significant at the moment. And so this tells you something about the structure of the industries, where the part-time jobs are, where the underemployment is. And I think it's a very interesting set of correlations, which is worthy of more detailed study, but just to highlight that some of the growth areas, like in healthcare, as well as in admin and support, are actually areas where there is a lot of part-time work and where there is a lot of underemployment. I think those things are quite significantly related, actually. Now, the next thing to talk about is the ABS published payroll data today. It fell by 0.9% nationally in the fortnight to the 5th of June. That was following a 0.4% rise in the previous fortnight. Now, that's obviously to do with the lockdown, partly. Almost every industry in Victoria saw a fall in payroll jobs during this period, the largest fall seen in the accommodation and food services and arts and recreation services, down 10.2% and 8%. Each lockdown, they said, sees falls in accommodation and food services payrolls, reflecting the impact that restrictions are having on the industry. And interestingly, the Northern Territory was the only state or territory with an increase in payroll jobs in the industry over the fortnight. So you can see there a considerable fall, down 10.2% in Victoria. But interestingly, it spilled over to other states too, including Tasmania down 3.5%, South Australia down 3.3%, the ACT down 2.2%, Queensland down 2%, and Western Australia down 1.1%. And then we've got New South Wales and only NT where it's gone up. So again, another factor to bear in mind, and maybe a reason why the overall levels of stress are actually still quite high. Here's another data point for you. This relates to the confidence. So the consumer confidence was up this week, according to Roy Morgan, and they basically said that the strong labour market recovery provided a boost to consumer confidence with a small gain, 1.3%. And the strength in the employment data overshadowed news about the emergence of the COVID cluster in Sydney. Well, we'll see about that. Confidence in the city rose by 5.2%, while in the rest of New South Wales it gained 2.8%. But just to highlight the fact that the confidence levels are still not that flash, and if things get worse in New South Wales and particularly in Sydney, and we are wondering whether there might be a lockdown of some sort coming, that could have another significant dent in terms of confidence. So this ain't over yet. And that then takes me just to recap the stress data that I shared with you last time. Mortgage stress is still quite high at 41.1%. That's more than 1.5 million households. A lot of those households are people with multiple part-time jobs, with big mortgages, with issues with getting the work they want, and also quite a few of them in those industries where they've got lots of part-time work and where you've got also issues relating to lockdown. So this is another indication, I think, that we've got to watch this ahead. And for those who didn't see the show last time, I just share the basic data again. I won't go through it in detail, but just to say that mortgage stress is at 41.13%, which is 1.528 million households, and rental stress shot up 38.24% of households in rental stress at 1.9 million households, and that's because a lot of people have been pushed out from where they were renting. Their rents have been increased, and at the same time, their income is being squashed. So that's another factor to bear in mind in terms of the overall economic output. And the point I really want to make is that whilst at the top line, some people may say the economy is doing pretty well, there are also some negative indicators that it's really important to get your head around to get a balanced view of how well the economy is going. I will just briefly touch on this from SQM, just to highlight the fact that the auction clearance rates are actually, you know, all over the place, really. 61% in Sydney, but again, not a vast number. Volumes are not actually that strong, despite all the spruiking in the mainstream media. I think that's important. The SQM data is the most accurate that I've seen with regard to what's happening with auctions. And in some other places, the auction rates are pretty low, and Perth, of course, hardly at all. And interestingly, the growth in Perth, in terms of what's happening to house prices, is pretty flat. And it's quite interesting to try and understand why that is. And the answer is, why is it that the momentum in Perth is not stronger? The answer is, the lending is tighter in Perth. The banks are still quite restricted in what they're going to lend over in the West because of some of the other earlier cycles of issues, and the fact that we've still got people who actually saw prices higher back in 2013 than they are now and are still in negative equity. So that's also another break there as well. So there are some structural reasons why it is that Perth property prices will not be moving up anything like as fast as in perhaps some other places. And I actually have some early data, which I'll share with you in a future post when I've done some more work on it, to suggest that we may be coming off the top of the growth rate of prices, particularly in houses and particularly in some areas of Sydney and Melbourne. So maybe the spike in prices is actually beginning to ease back. We'll see. It's early to say, but that's what I'm beginning to form a view on. Now, if I then go more broadly and just talk a little bit about the US markets, because, of course, whatever we do and whatever we think about investing in the local markets here, we need to be thinking also about what's happening internationally, because, frankly, what happens over there has a very significant impact with what happens here. And there's some very important information now which I want to share with you, which to me underscores why I am still of the view that we are probably going to see some market corrections later in the year. I don't know quite precisely when, and I don't want to be like Harry Dent when he keeps saying, well, it's going to be next week and next week, and then it sort of kicks on and it doesn't happen, right? But the fact of the matter is the conditions are now there to suggest that we are going to start seeing a correction relatively quickly. And let me share with you some of that information to try and give you a sense of why I'm saying that. This is actually from stuff from Bloomberg out today. And the really interesting thing is that, in fact, the Fed is already squeezing. And so this is a chart of the annual real M2 money supply here. And the right scale is the US federal deficit as a percentage of nominal GDP. And essentially, what this tells us is that over the last couple of months, the liquidity is actually being drained away, partly, of course, by the actions or inactions of the elected politicians, as well as what the Fed is doing. And while they're still doing their $120 billion a month in terms of bond purchases, the overall net position is actually going into reverse. Now, if you think about the consequences of that, if you think about the fact that we could be in the situation where essentially what we've got is liquidity being drained out of the system, and that is actually not indicative of very strong inflation, nor indeed very strong economic momentum. And as Biden is still struggling to negotiate a further stimulus package, which may or may not come through, we're not sure what size it would be, heard all sorts of numbers being thrown around, this is a very important number, because this is showing that the Fed is actually squeezing already, and the US economy is therefore being squeezed. And that will be a very important factor, I think, looking forward. Now, here's another piece of information which also sort of just builds onto that a bit further. So this is showing the sorts of impacts that happen to the markets when there is monetary tightening. And you can see here, the one on the left-hand side shows that in extreme monetary tightening, you can actually get a fall of, well, 46.5% is what they're modelling, 25% in a slightly average tightening, and a mild tightening, a lower 19%. But there's still some very interesting stuff there. And this is from 1970 to 2021, some analysis done. And you can also look at the S&P 500 with fiscal tightening. And again, you can see 36% in an extreme fiscal tightening, a lower rate for average and a lower rate for mild. So together, what we can actually say is that the sources of new money suddenly decreasing, either fiscal and or monetary, are able to have a very significant impact on the market. And so the conclusion that they came to was this: on that basis, the odds of a forthcoming fall in the stock market has become very significant. On this reading, we had seen a gradual dawning on investors' minds that the speed of help for them was slowing down, which crystallized in last week's FOMC. And sort of the conclusion of that is that the latest Federal Open Market Committee meeting was bond positive and stock negative. So put that together with the earlier data that I shared with you, and you can perhaps see some of the ambience that's going on at the moment and why it is that things may not be as strong as superficially they appear. Now, here's another piece of information, and that's about US production. And this is a long-term chart from 1950 to 2019. And basically what it showed is that manufacturing basically stopped growing about 20 years ago. It's gone up and down a little bit, but basically hardly anything. And yeah, sure, there was the NAFTA trade agreement. There was the Chinese access to world trade in 2001. That probably had quite a significant impact. But there is not much evidence of production growth in the US. So that's a very important observation, because what it means is that the bulk of the US economy then is being driven by things like housing and lending to households, and also, of course, all the financial markets and the financial services stuff. But real meat and potatoes activity in the US relating to production actually has stalled for the last 20 years. That is structurally a very important issue. And the conclusion of all that is we might actually be quite close to midnight. So, again, from Bloomberg, the S&P 500 moved sideways for months after the NASDAQ peaked in 2000. You know, so basically, there was a peak up and then there was a NASDAQ fall, but the S&P went sideways and down. And the question is, could you actually analyze that Bitcoin in a similar way? You know, has Bitcoin basically called the top, as it were? And could it be that the S&P 500 is due for a fall? So those are sorts of some of the questions that some serious analysts are now beginning to question, which may be where we are. So whilst we are at strong positions at the moment with regards to the markets here and over there, the question is, what's ahead? Is it likely that things will go higher? Or are some of these factors that I've explained really suggesting that it might go the other way? And if it does, that means that there is potential for considerable market corrections. And to put it another way, this is from Morgan Stanley, basically said, the tightening, you know, began months ago. The Fed's pivot to begin the tightening discussion caught most by surprise. Markets began discounting this inevitable process months ago, in our view. It's actually at the mid-cycle transition. It transitions all about. Until M2 growth is done deaccelerating, the transition is incomplete. In other words, we are in a tightening phase already. So the conversation about the Fed tapering and all of those things is sort of missing the point. That's what Morgan Stanley is arguing. I think there's some truth in that. And they also went on to say that if you look at it carefully through different types of assets, the more risk on assets are the ones that potentially are moving differently to some of the others. And so therefore, the stimulus programs, et cetera, and the other things could mean that there's potentially a risk of overconsumption quite recently turning negative. And that means that basically the positive effects on income from the stimulus checks and the surge in asset prices, including crypto, all fade. And so that could be what's ahead of us. Now, if that is true, that's a big deal. So I thought it was worth just sharing that information. You know, there was one last chart that they put up, which I thought was quite interesting, that the US money supply is slowing. Global M2 is slowing. And so essentially, maybe valuations and relative revisions have turned down. And if we're right about that dynamic, then markets are probably overvalued and will correct. It's just a question of when. And it's not necessarily going to be triggered by the Fed starting to taper. The structural changes are already in the system. Right? That's a really important thing to understand. In other words, we are already in a tightening phase, and nobody really wants to talk about that, but that's probably one of the most important factors to think about. Okay, so I think that's a good place probably to break the presentation at this stage. I wanted to go through that in sort of a structured way because for me, there were some really, really important messages there. But, you know, I could be completely completely wrong on it. But I do think that we are, you know, facing some quite interesting challenges ahead. And I thought what I might do just before I look at the chat in more detail is just have a quick look at the markets insofar that, you know, it's been quite an interesting ride. This is actually let's just go down here and have a look at a couple of the charts, right? So this is the ASX 200, which did pretty well today. It was up 1.48% to 7,342. The financials were also up strongly, 2% to 6,575. The volatility index was down 6.76%, right? And the banks were doing pretty well here. Of course, Bank of Queensland in particular, which was up more than 5% at 9.26, is reacting to the confirmation of the ME Bank merger. So that's one of the reasons that that's there. But this is quite an interesting one insofar that the Aussie dollar is now dropped. It's around 75. And so you can see that that's not as low as it has been, but it's still pretty low, frankly. And I thought this was quite interesting too. The 3-year bond rate is now up, right? So we're starting to see a rotation in terms of short term, long term. That's 3-year and that's the 10-year, right? So in other words, rates nearer term are perhaps higher. Now that could be quite interesting. Now, I will just quickly touch on the Dow Jones, which of course did quite well. It actually was up 1.76% yesterday, having of course fallen the previous day, and the S&P 100 a bit the same really, and the 500, of course the critical 500, also was up 1.4%. The NASDAQ was also up 0.79%, and the VIX volatility index was up just a little. But of course the techs were up quite strongly, whereas, of course, as we discussed in the pre-chat, you know, the Bitcoin was down 5.16%. As I discussed in my earlier post, that's partly to do with China coming in and saying no more Bitcoin mining and no more Bitcoin trading in China, right? Now, whether that will stick, who knows, but it's pretty significant. Ethereum was down 6.6%, and Dogecoin or Doggycoin, depending on what you want to call it, was down 20%. Even Coinbase, the you know, big trading company, was down 2.92%. And interestingly, the you know, the various cryptos, wherever you look, is pretty much exhibiting the same sort of stuff. Now, obviously, the ones with a stable coin haven't moved around as much. But so we can see that there's a lot of volatility here. And remember that a lot of people benefit from volatility and trading volatility, right? And, you know, particularly some of the large firms have reported significant financial profits over the last quarter because they've been trading very volatile stocks. And, of course, cryptos and other things. So it's pretty interesting what's going on. Right. Now, with that introduction, let me just come back here and see what else is going on. And, Jason, I really appreciate the contribution. Thank you. Thank you very much. It really is appreciated. Now, TB said, I know that our stock market just follows the US. Does that mean the Fed government has no control on when our market goes? Well, I think the truth is that our market mirrors very strongly the US. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Firstly, of course, we get a lot of our investment internationally from the US. And I'd also make the point that the size of our market is so small relative to the Fed, so that whatever the Fed does, it has a massive international flow simply because the US dollar, of course, is the international base currency, as it were. So that's the reason. Now, of course, we have a higher exposure to resources. And up till quite recently, that higher exposure to resources allowed us then to essentially slightly distance ourselves with regard to China because of the very strong trades with China. That's beginning to change, and as that begins to change, it's going to be a much more connected set of movements to the US. So whatever the US does, frankly, it's going to come over here. It's quite clear. Now, Debt and Regret asked this question, and the Australian housing bubble seems to be bulletproof. Will it ever come back to a realistic price, even if we have a market correction and higher prices? Now, that's a very good question, and thanks for the super chat as well. Look, I think we have in this in Australia, and I've gone through this in a number of recent posts, we have massive government reserve bank support to the housing market directly and indirectly. And that's including the term funding facility, which is coming off at the end of June. That means that the banks will not get the cheap money anymore. They'll have to actually raise it either from deposits or maybe from international markets. So there's a upward tick on mortgage rates. We also know that the government has thrown yet more money to try and get more first-time buyers into the market. And just to be clear, I want there to be no doubt in anybody's mind that those first-time buyer incentives are more about protecting the construction industry than they are about helping people to afford to get into the market, right? Housing affordability is chronically bad at the moment, and there is no plan anywhere at a federal or a state level to deal with it, as there is no plan to deal with the social housing needs that we actually have across the country. So if they were serious about tackling this, those are some of the things they'd be doing. But they're not. What they're paranoid about is any risk to the banking sector. Now, because the banks are so leveraged to property and because they've basically been lending very hard, what they want to do is to keep prices up. Now, the question is that feasible given the income multiples that we know about? Given that perhaps one in five loans now have liar loan components to it. There was a report today that suggested a lot of people weren't telling truths about their own financial position when they were applying for a loan. There are lots of issues there. Plus, of course, there's the interesting question about responsible lending. Will that get swept away or will responsible lending stay? There's no news that I've heard so far as to whether the Greens have actually brought their motion yet, but they're planning to whisk the changes to responsible lending away so that consumers are still protected. That could be another factor. And so there's a bunch of things going on here which suggests to me that in the short term, the strong momentum of house price growth is probably going to ease back from this point. In fact, my modelling is suggesting small levels of growth in some areas, particularly houses, less units. Units are way down in most the metro areas even now, in down 20% in some cases. Houses, quite different. So a lot of houses, particularly at the upper end of the market, are actually still rising a little bit. But you've got to understand this important point. The way the metrics work in terms of house price growth, it's based on the transaction throughput, right? Transaction throughput is not that strong, despite what everyone's been claiming. And transaction throughput is skewed to the top end of the market, where people have been spending big bucks without a mortgage because they got the money to buy it. So that part of the market is actually a little bit disconnected from the, you know, the meat and potatoes up to the mortgage. If you look carefully at house price movements in the middle end of the market, as I have, it's certainly not growth everywhere. And in fact, I was looking at a suburb which I will put up over the next couple of days, in the urban ring in Sydney, where there was growth last year, but there's been no growth this year at all. And that's in houses. And the average house price there was about $1.5 to $2 million. So the point I'm trying to make is that, sure, we're in very high plateau territory. All of the incentive schemes and all of the processes from federal, state and the Reserve Bank is trying to keep this bubble up. But we are still ultimately in the situation where we're way above long-term norms. And then it's a question of, can they go on throwing enough stuff to try and keep it up? Or will it ultimately begin to correct? And my own view would be this. If we start seeing the stock market beginning to move down, that could be the start of the next down phase. If we see focus from the Reserve Bank on loan-to-income ratios or debt-to-income ratios, and of course I shared again a post a couple of days ago with regard to New Zealand and what the New Zealand Reserve Bank is talking about there about putting hurdles so that banks can't lend as much. If any of that comes through, that could be another negative impact. Remember that the migration is zero or close to zero, other than some Australians coming back, many of whom are coming back with big buckets of money from working overseas. So they are buying into the top end of the market rather than at the bottom end of the market, very different from previously. And of course, the supply of investment properties is still quite strong. They're still building way more. They're still wanting to put more planning applications in. So significant supply. And I've said several times, you know, the critical thing to bear in mind is that we've got 1.2 to 1.4 million spare properties across Australia. So there is very little supply side issues, despite, of course, what the real estate sector and the construction sector are saying. This is all about debt, credit, saving the banks. So ultimately, the question of what happens to house prices is how much more will the Reserve Bank and the government do to protect the banks? That's the key question. And on past history, they will do a hell of a lot more. So I don't believe necessarily that prices will slide quickly, but they will probably go sideways and over time perhaps adjust down a little. It's interesting that even in New Zealand, where they've started intervening, price growth is still there. It's just not quite as strong. So that's probably the way that I'm thinking about it. All right, let me go back and have a look at the some of the comments and see what questions that have come through. A lot of questions, of course, as I'm... As Cookie Boys put so succinctly, the RBA is stuck in a big hole when it comes to rates. If other countries raise and we don't, the dollar tanks, import inflation takes off, so they'll have to raise. Yeah, I think they probably will. And look, they've said that they don't want to raise rates for, you know, quite a long period of time. They will be forced to if international moves are higher. And it's very interesting, I was listening to some people from the UK talking about the UK economy where the government borrowing has actually come back a little bit. And now they're starting to talk about raising rates sooner. And of course, if the ambience around the world is that rates start to go up, we can't ignore that, right? Because as you say, Cookie Boy, the exchange rate will get crushed. Now, they'd like the exchange rate a bit lower because, of course, that would help in terms of trade. But the fact is that we would then bring more inflation in. And it's worth just reflecting briefly on this concept of inflation, right? Because you can have inflation of costs. You know, there are costs rising. Health costs are up significantly. Some fuel prices are up significantly. Some food stuffs are up significantly in terms of price. But there's no real evidence yet of wage pricing inflation. And that would, be a very different and significant indicator of structural inflation coming if wages started to rise significantly. But we'll have to wait and see whether that happens. Then you've got asset prices. And of course, asset prices, as we've discussed, stock market's very high, house prices very high. But those sorts of price dimensions are not flowing directly through into any of the official CPI numbers. And of course, I've said before that the CPI numbers are pretty rubbish when it comes to actually trying to understand what's really going on. But the fact is that the official numbers, of course, conveniently skirt around things like asset prices and house prices. They have this sort of rental proxy. Until recently, of course, rents were dropping. That meant that costs of living were actually for housing was going down rather than up, which is a bit nuts, right? That's the second type of inflation. The third type is the one that I discussed with Damien Klassen over two or three shows quite recently, which is to do with these mathematical movements when there's a big dip and then it comes up. then the up move looks a lot stronger than it really is. So that's, if you like, the peak to trough moves. And then the other is this disruption, the supply chain disruption, which is very significant. Like lumber went through the roof. It's come back now because basically they started chopping down more trees and putting more through the system. Now, of course, we are more exposed because we are reliant on many more imports than, for example, the US, and the container prices have gone through the roof. So that's another cost which will be added. But even if you put all those costs in, overall, the net cost coming into Australia isn't necessarily that high. So to me, we do have tactical inflation. I'm not sure we've got structural inflation, and I'm pretty sure that there's no wages inflation, which would be, for me, the critical leverage point that would highlight a change in strategy. So that's how I think about inflation. And there are lots of other models and lots of other ways of thinking about it, but that's my own view. So, and I still think there is an argument for saying that a lot of what's going on around the world could now be deflationary, right? I've highlighted the fact that the Fed and US stimulus is sort of going into reverse, despite what everybody's thinking, right? Now, that's deflationary, right? When they lend less, that's deflationary. When they throw less money out there in terms of handing out checks to people, that's deflationary. So there is a really significant risk here of deflation rather than inflation, or at least we might get stagflation, which basically means cost of living go up, but wages don't, and that's the worst case that I see. And I have a nasty feeling that could be perhaps where we're going to end up in Australia, where effectively we have costs rising, wages not, and more households then getting more caught. Big debt, of course. Then interest rates start to move up, because, of course, that's the other factor in all of this. Rates are very low at the moment. They will move up eventually. So there are a lot of important elements, and it could well be that we see, like CBA, they adjusted their benchmark rate for mortgages just slightly, 15 basis points, but others will do that to try and allow a bit more flexibility if rates do start to rise. So, you know, it's not all downhill is what I'm trying to say, and there are a lot of different factors that we need to get our heads around if we're trying to understand what's going on. And of course, that in turn translates then into a series of questions about where do I invest, how do I invest, what do I invest in, right? Because this ain't straightforward. Okay, let's see what else we've got in terms of other questions. Master Singleton asked this one. What are your thoughts on first home buyers with just enough money to pay for a deposit? Well, yeah, the average number I've seen is for Sydney, 10.1 years for a first time buyer, I think is the latest, if you're going to save for a deposit. Of course, some first time buyers have the Bank of Mum and Dad, and I've done several shows on that. So that's intergenerational wealth transfer to allow them to buy. And so that's quite strong. About 60% of first-time buyers have access to intergenerational funds. The parents, of course, enjoying the price growth, pull the equity out, hand it down to the next generation. But that's not good if you're a household without rich parents. And many people, of course, because of these fragmented part-time jobs, are hardly able to save for a deposit at all. And then, of course, they're thrown these lifelines from, you know, the state and federal government with the incentives to try and buy, like the 95% loan. And I discussed that with Edwin yesterday. The issue about the 95% loan is you've just got to pay it back. And in fact, of course, the amount you'd be paying will be quite a lot higher simply because the rate will be a bit higher, but the amount you're borrowing is higher as well because the government is not paying your interest principal repayments between 80 and 95%, all they're doing is guaranteeing the bank, they're protecting the bank. In other words, they're like a lender's mortgage insurer of last resort for the bank. And again, I keep coming back to this to say those stimulus packages are more about protecting the bank and helping the bank to lend than they are actually helping real households buy real properties. And yet, of course, the way it's positioned is just remarkably deceptive. And another one from Master Singleton. The recently Domain put a report saying that it would take first home buyers 7 years to save for a deposit for a house. Depends where you look and what they're saving for. It's probably longer than that, as I said earlier on. And interestingly, of course, if prices are continuing to run away, then they're basically not saving enough to catch up. I did a report the other day from an article that was in the SMH that made the point that the growth of the average house is bigger than the average saving that can be made by the average saver. So that they're actually getting further away from being able to buy rather than actually anything else. It's nuts, absolute nuts. All right, let's see what else we've got. Cross-stitch Ange says, can we talk about investing in ourselves, education such as uni, TAFE, etc.? That's a great comment. And, you know, I find it really quite sad, and I've made this comment several times on this channel and with Tarek as well, that, you know, we had the opportunity. There was a big pool of money that the bank, that the government used through COVID, right? And yet, of course, it was, most of it was thrown just at big corporations who didn't need it in the first place. Think of what would happen if that money had gone into investing in education and training and those sorts of things, you know, in real big volumes. Think of how much that could have changed the shape of our economy. So unfortunately, there is no ideological support for real capability building in the country. And that's something that I'm very, very annoyed about, because it's the future. We are not investing in our future. We are investing in, you know, building more houses and supporting the construction sector and supporting the banks, not actually investing in our future. So education, training, all of those things for me are absolutely critical and should be absolutely at the centre of any policy. And yet they're almost sort of squeezed to the edge. And of course, I know that there's issues with healthcare costs and aged care costs and those sorts of things. But these sorts of investments are actually investments in our future, our collective future. And, you know, successful countries around the world invest in the future. In Australia, we are investing in the present. And unfortunately, the present is just repeating the mistakes of the past rather than laying a foundation for a better future. So that's why I think it's a big deal. Now, Ray asks, could less saving be increasing prices mean less chance to save? Yeah, well, people are, of course, are already draining their savings, as I showed you earlier on. Now, of course, the point about that is that households are in different positions. There are some that are actually very affluent and are actually able to spend almost, you know, without noticing. Others are actually in a different position and they've got small amounts of saving which they're draining away. Unfortunately, quite a lot of them are now draining those savings, though, into just supporting day-to-day requirements. That's why the mortgage stress numbers are so high. So I'm seeing in my surveys a lot of people whose income is below what their outgoings are. And the way they square the circle is either to go get more money on a credit card, or if they've got savings in the bank, they're eating those savings up. And that's why in my numbers, whether you are actually raiding your credit card or whether you're actually using your existing savings, if you're actually paying out more than's coming in, I put people in the stress category, right? Because you can't go on doing that. Eventually the savings evaporate. Interesting question from AI as well. Well, that is, could another lockdown increase savings? Well, sure, what tends to happen is if things are locked down, then people can't spend, right? So they then, and they're not going overseas either, so that means they've got ability to save again. So, and you know, the broad observation I have here is we have created this Fortress Australia, right? So we've got this, these borders which are a bit permeable with the virus at the borders, but nevertheless, people can't go overseas, so they can't spend the billions of dollars they would normally spend overseas on holidays and travel and those sorts of things. So they're spending it here. And we've also lost a lot of those temporary migrants, as I discussed earlier on, so that means that more people are now working in local jobs, low-paid, part-time, rather grindy jobs, but jobs nevertheless. Now, that sort of border strategy and that sort of Fortress Australia strategy can go on for a reasonable length of time, right? But ultimately, the question is, how are we going to actually realign ourselves to the rest of the global economy? Because the rest of the global economy is beginning to get to the point where the vaccine rollout is at the point where they can start opening up again. And so if we've got our Fortress Australia border protecting the economic microclimate that we've created here, I think that there will be a there'll be a bit of a temptation from the current government to go to the election before we open up, because the hothouse is economically better, if you look at it superficially, than it would otherwise be. Trouble is, it's not sustainable long term, and that's why I think we're in this really weird no man's land, as it were, And of course, as more lockdowns come, as you say, maybe people will save more. Smooth operator makes this point. Lost another rental property on income. It's crap. Yeah, there's quite a few people, you know, with multiple investment properties who've still got quite a few not actually let now. And in fact, the vacancy rates in some areas are quite high. In other areas, what's happened is that we've got people who kicked out one old tenant, put the rent up, and then tried to get a new tenant and then couldn't. And I'm seeing that in my surveys and a couple of one-on-one conversations recently. So people need to be a bit cautious about this because effectively, you know, maybe the tenant in the hand is worth two in the bush, if I can steal a phrase, right? That's pretty interesting, though. And TB makes the comment about the net savings rate. Yeah, it is interesting. It's dropping quite dramatically, and it's not uniformly across all segments, right? So again, in my surveys, I see some groups who've had that little nest egg now pretty much eroded away. I'm seeing other segments where they've still got plenty of money and they're not really worrying too much. And that's part of the issue here, right? And I keep talking about the K-shaped economy in Australia, right? We've got a group of people who are doing quite well and are quite affluent and are enjoying the growth in property prices and the growth in the share prices. But you've got this other group, the very large group, who are actually being caught. And so that's where the savings ratio is quite interesting. When you go granular, you can't just look at an aggregate level. Crooked Boy said Roy Morgan for the win. Yeah, I think the Roy Morgan data is actually much more powerful. It is more aligned with my survey data. It's what I'm seeing in my data sets. And, you know, the ABS official numbers, official quote-unquote, are just so off the truth, it's laughable, really. And then, of course, you know, you find the 300,000 jobs that from temporary migrants that weren't included, and you think, well, hang on a moment, that means the number's just way off. And Master Singles makes the same point. I trust Roy Morgan data more than the ABS on the employment. Yep. And on the confidence. The Roy Morgan confidence numbers are pretty close to my own. I haven't actually published mine that recently simply because I think Roy Morgan does a really good job and there's no point in just duplicating. Now, this is from Ray. Does the gig economy lead to more unemployment, underemployment? Yeah, the short answer is yes, absolutely. So when you've got piecemeal working and when you've got the gig economy, there are people doing the odd hour here and there. Remember the old definition from the ABS? If you work an hour, you're employed, right? That goes into that bucket rather than the unemployed bucket, right? Now, there are a lot of people who are actually in the gig economy world working just a few hours, not being paid very much. And, you know, superficially in the numbers, that would look right. But if you look at it in terms of my cash flow data, it's not right at all. So absolutely, it's definitely distorting it. Cookie Boy asked about the New South Wales stamp duty removal. I personally think it's about pushing prices higher, higher tax revenue long term and raising taxes elsewhere. Yeah, I think you're right with that, Cookie. I mean, to my mind, the excuse is it's taking a huge hurdle off people, except two things. One is you're committing to paying into the future at an unknown rate, so you don't know what you're committing to. And secondly, they will have, as they migrate from a big chunk of money to a flow of money, to find other ways to fill the gap. You know, $9 billion, I think, was the last number I saw from the New South Wales budget. That's a huge amount. So, yeah, I think that's right. And it's going to actually push prices higher because it means that people won't need to pay as much in stamp duty, which means they can afford to pay a bit more, right? So yeah, expect house prices to continue to elevate where those stamp duties are removed. And, you know, I would be very cautious if I was given the choice of stamp duty or a cash flow over time. I would think long and hard before I commit to paying every year for every year when I don't know what the rate will be. I don't know how much it will go up. And, you know, I don't know how long I'm going to live in the same property, but if it's a few years, I'm going to end up paying a lot more later over the life of the property relative to the stamp duty that you pay up front. So for me, it's a con. What else have we got? Now, Ryan asked an interesting question. What's the best way to measure housing affordability? It seems the media doesn't want an honest discussion about it, pointing to the low rates. Yeah, very, very good question. So the way to think about it is, and this is the way I do it in my stress modeling, is I say, if I take a household, right, and I look at the household budget, I know what money's coming in, I know what money's going out. How much can they afford to pay for either rent or a mortgage? Now, there isn't a standard formula like 30%. I mean, it used to be 30% that was often quoted. That's all over the place now. So there are some people with a lot higher and a lot of people with a lot lower. I think people have to actually do the calculation for themselves and basically make some assumptions about what is my income going to be? What is the amount I can actually afford to pay, and then sensitize it to interest rate rises? Because that's the other point. Affordability is not just about today's rates. Affordability is over the medium term. And remember, the interest rates are likely to rise. The bank will be working on a bit of a buffer. A lot of households that I speak with in my surveys don't do the same calculations with a buffer themselves. They basically say, what's the minimum I can get away with paying now? And don't ask any questions about what happens if rates go up. So they're then caught. And the other point here is that the banks have a different mental model in terms of affordability, because they ask two questions. The first question is my loan at risk? And of course, if you've got equity in the property, they could always sell the property, repay the loan, so the risk scale goes down. The second is the cash flow going to actually trip any of the big hurdles? Because there are some hurdles that they still have, responsible lending hurdles and those sorts of things. And if not, then they'll make the loan. Now, those are not very accurate when it comes to true affordability. So there's a real mask over this. And then, of course, everybody defaults back to, well, of course, interest rates are really low. So therefore, affordability is actually, pretty good. Except if you've got a principal interest, you've still got to pay the principal every month too. And as the interest rate comes down, the proportion that you're paying every month is actually more and more principal rather than the interest, right? So as rates come down, there is a floor below which, in fact, affordability doesn't get better. And now we're there now, pretty much. And then, of course, the last point again is, if people are going to actually think about shifting later and, buying and selling and transacting, there's a lot of costs involved there. And that's, again, people don't think about those. So not only do you think about the steady state cash flow, but you've got to think about all the costs of acquiring the property and, getting the survey done and paying the stamp duty and all those things as well. Very few people model that before they commit. I'm very concerned about that. They should definitely do more work. Run some sensitivities in terms of what happens if interest rates go up 2 or 3%. And the other sensitivity is, what happens if my income gets disrupted? If it's two incomes, what happens if one income disappears? Those are the sorts of things that people do. Then they'd have a better handle over what affordability was. But, of course, that's a more complicated conversation, and the media can't cope with complicated conversations. So. A Yogi Bear asked this question: what's the forecast on house listings looking like? General thoughts on what's going on with them? Yeah, well, there's quite a lot of information coming through my surveys that's suggesting that more people are considering listing, particularly some property investors. Quite a few units are coming through. Houses, less so. So I think there's still a significant undersupply in some areas of houses, and a lot of people are down traders. They're looking to sell and to sort of get maximum equity out because they want to release equity, buy something smaller, maybe buy some investments and things as well, or maybe give it to the kids, right? And it's not uniform across the country, and it's not uniform across even postcodes. So it's going to be patchy. My own read of the situation is we will see a bigger supply coming on in the spring. And I've had a couple of conversations with some mortgage brokers and some real estate agents recently that suggesting there's been a real change in the weather in the last 6 weeks or so, where we had earlier on massive demand from prospective buyers, absolutely well over the supply. It's turning around now, and they're starting to see greater supply and less appetite from buyers, and actually buyers being a bit more coy about paying. So we'll see. Also varies by location. So there's still a bit of migration from Victoria up towards Queensland. Still quite a lot of moving away from smaller properties into areas where there are bigger plots. And There is this other thing that's going on, and that is still people are buying up a plot with a view to subdivision and building villas on it and those sorts of things. That's still pretty potent, actually. So that's something else that's there in the mix as well. So all of that's changing the story. That's why these one-on-one conversations are actually really useful, because then you can get granular and really understand the dynamics of a particular postcode. And, you know, when you start looking at that, you realise how different those postcodes are. And, you know, you compare some of the ones I've done recently, if you go back and watch those back shows, you can see how different the dynamics are in different locations. So that's a short summary of what I'm seeing at the moment with regard to listings. What else have I got? Ray makes the point, it would be good to see the male-female ratio of changes in employment, underemployment. Yeah, that's true. In fact, there's been quite a rise in female employment relative to where it was previously. That the females got hit on over the head by a 4x2 through the lockdowns. So some of those have come back now, and that's partly because of all the healthcare jobs and those sorts of things. I am actually so seeing now more males than a year ago in multiple part-time roles. And that's partly because some jobs have disappeared. Other jobs have actually morphed into smaller working hours. So we've got more males now, in my data, working multiple part-time jobs than previously. And that's not a good trend in my view, not least because very often it means that less people, you know, people get less money and income coming in as a result. Madeline's got a problem with the phone. It keeps sending the thing before she's finished sending it. Okay, keep going. We'll get there. Cross-stitch Ange says, I've been casual working 38 hours a week for the past 3 years. My contract's renewed 6 months before they expire. I get no annual or sick leave, but my weekly pay is high. Yeah, that's it's certainly the way that it's done in a number of areas. A lot of people in the academic area, of course, similar situation now. They're actually, you know, relatively fragmented piecemeal type roles, whereas previously they would have been working full time. And they also avoid paying holidays and sick pay and those things too. But, you know, it's a matter of trading off. You know, some people like the flexibility. Others would prefer different things if they could get it, but they can't. Now, this is from, I can't pronounce that. If commodities are relatively high, why is the Aussie dollar somewhat low? The reason the Aussie dollar is down is because the US dollar is up. So basically, you need to understand the sort of interplay between the strength of the US dollar and the Aussie dollar. When the US dollar is going up, as it is going up, if you look at the DXY, in other words, the you know, the dollar index, it's up where it was previously. That means that our dollars come back as a result of it. So it's more to do with what's happening in the US than our own situation. And in fact, the Reserve Bank would quite like to have the Aussie dollar lower, because it would help our trade. But the chances of them doing that is actually quite limited, I think, at the moment. Let me just show you the DXY. There you go. I'll show that there. If I put that one, there you go. So that's the DXY. You can see it's come up recently. It's at 92 now, whereas previously it was down to 89. So that's sort of the movement, and that is the, if you like, the other half of the movement compared with the Aussie dollar. So that's the reason. Whatever happens in the US, we go the other way. Okay. What else have we got? Mr. Cookie says, so Cookie says, Westpac says rates are rising in 2023. How long before we hear 2022? Sooner rather than later. I think rates will have to rise. Also bear in mind this, we're talking two things. The cash rate, which is the one that's set by the Reserve Bank, is the one that Westpac's talking about. Right? I am talking about real life rates, mortgage rates, right? The term funding facility ends at the end of June. That's the really cheap money, the 0.1% money. Banks will have now to access more expensive funds to be able to fund their book going forward, unless they change it again. If they do that, their margins will be squeezed. They will probably have to pay more on deposit, and that means that they're going to have to pay more on loans. So I'm already expecting to see mortgage rates rising over the next few months, a little. Not necessarily the variable, but certainly the fixed rates are already moving. And CBA, as I mentioned earlier on, actually changed the base calculation by 15 basis points to allow for that. So I'm expecting to see those rates first. I think the Reserve Bank will try and hang on and not move sooner, but they could be bounced by the Fed if they start moving. And of course, we've also got other economies around the world, UK economy, Eurozone, of course, as well. So got to be careful about which rates we're talking about. Reserve Bank benchmark rate, by the way, the cash rate, is almost no relationship to the cost of anything when it comes to funding loan books and things. So in a way, it's a bit of a sort of a furphy in terms of what they do, right? So they make a big play of it, but actually it's not the real story, right? The real story is the three-year control of the yield curve. As I highlighted, that's maybe now beginning to wobble a little bit. And of course, when that ends, that's when we start to see the real move up. In the meantime, I think the banks will have to pay more for their funds. That will put more pressure on mortgage rates, in my view. Interesting comment from Master Singleton, and that is that commercial rates are rising, yet SMEs are struggling. Yeah, I agree. Again, in my surveys, a lot of SMEs that I speak to in my surveys are saying, we can't afford to pay those rising rents. And, you know, a lot of them had back arrears because they were basically allowed to not pay for a period of time. But many SMEs are still struggling. So, it's not just in a particular geographic area or indeed an industry. It's quite widespread. I reckon about 40% of SMEs have some issues with regard to their cash flow at the moment. And it's getting worse, not better. And again, remember, we've also got this other issue now where the bankruptcies are actually now allowed to flow through, whereas previously they were stopped. I was talking to the other day, talking to somebody who's dealing with the handling of distressed businesses and the closure of businesses, and they're starting to get very busy now, whereas previously they were very, very quiet. And there are some changed rules in terms of how quickly people can actually deal with closing a business down, but nevertheless, there are increasing numbers, and the rental issue and also the fact that they still are obliged to pay money to the tax man is going to be a big deal. Okay, this is from Lily. Interesting question there. What are your thoughts on the job people are working from home being transitioned out of Australia to a cheaper market overseas? Well, it's an interesting question that, because, of course, we've had a number of large organisations move jobs overseas, and then effectively the service levels drop, and they then pull them back to Australia. Some of the banks have gone through that cycle. So I'm not sure whether that's necessarily going to happen at the sort of the macro level, but I know that there are a number of smaller organisations who've now realised just what you're saying, that they can actually source skills and capabilities internationally, virtually, and pay a third of the price. Now, given what I said about the pressure on small businesses, I think a number of those could be using those services. So I think it's going to be a big deal. I think it will be a further swing in terms of the employment landscape in Australia. And with some of the high-tech businesses in particular, some of the best skills are actually not here in Australia. They're actually available internationally. So they would quite often reach out there. And the final question is, what about the government sector? You know, they're always now looking to try and save a dollar or two. I wonder whether they'll look at that, or whether, in fact, the publicity, if it got found out, would be so great they'd have to not do it. So it'd be interesting to watch that. But small businesses, absolutely, they're going down that route. Now, the new voice talked about venture capital firms buying up property, not just venture capital, BlackRock's buying up. A lot of the property in the US is being bought up with a view to essentially holding it and then selling it again and making a profit, or holding it and renting it out. It's a big deal, and it's a huge impact in some areas in terms of rising prices. Unfortunately, those prices are actually not helping the broader economy. And interestingly, the momentum in the US property market is quite strong. I just want to make the point, of course, that the US property market, our property market, New Zealand, the UK, they're all quite strong. Low interest rates, all those things that are there. But the phenomenon of venture firms and BlackRock and those people buying up property in the US, I've not seen it yet in Australia. If you know different, let me know. Send me a message, because I'll be interested to know. But I haven't seen any evidence yet. But there's a risk that somebody starts that process here, particularly if prices go on rising. So it's something to watch.
Yeah.
Happy Robot says, 70-year debt cycle go boom. Well, there are these long-term trend cycles. You know, Harry Dent and others are on about that. And quite a few of them argue that next year is when a lot of it lands. Now, of course, that may be a flex because of the stimulus packages and the central bank intervention. But nevertheless, these big cycles do tend to come to a bit of an end. Then, of course, is what next? And that takes us into a conversation about negative interest rates, central bank digital currencies, about all of those things, right? Even things like UBI. What happens after that? Don't know. Probably subject to a separate show, but it's interesting. These long cycles, I think, are actually... You know, when I started looking at this years ago, I always thought, nah, I can't be right. How can you possibly see these long cycles? But the more I look at it, the more I think that people like Harry Dent are onto something. It's just that maybe sometimes they're a bit too definitive on precisely when it hits. Now, Greengrass is staying still on for August, September. So I assume you're talking about when I think the markets might correct. I'm still saying September. I've said that for about the last 9 months. I could be wrong. Remember, Harry Dent has been wrong for longer than I've been wrong when it comes to market corrections. But look, it's interesting that if you look statistically speaking, when do markets start coming back after the summer? September, right? And when does the stimulus start winding off? Well, it's already starting, as I said, but it's going to hit a bit of a junction in September. So maybe I'm wrong. I think September could be interesting, but it does depend on the virus. If the virus comes back and we have more lockdowns and they have to throw more money at this, it could push it out a lot further. So in a way, it is contingent upon what happens with regard to the virus. And in my core scenarios, as you know, I have three based on the trajectory of the virus, because the virus and what happens to the virus is so connected to the economy. It's not like either or, it is the economy, frankly. It will affect it so dramatically. So that's the way I think about it. Now, Javier asks about confiscation of wealth after a market crash. There's a risk of that. You know, we've talked in the past about bail-in of banks and those sorts of things. Of course, in earlier cycles, gold was grabbed. So yeah, it is a bit of an unknown quantity. And the question is, will they? Could they? Well, they certainly could. Will they? Depends a little bit, I suspect, on the state of play at the time. I think that the superannuation balances of people will be potentially of interest to governments, particularly here in Australia, because they're so big. I also think that some of the super funds, you know, where they've invested, what they've invested in, that may change as well. So I think got to watch this and, again, be cautious and careful about laying the foundations for flexibility. I think flexibility for me is one of the keys that I would hold on to at the moment, because there are a lot of unknowns. And I guess the message from this show tonight is... don't be fooled by thinking that this is all over, that everything is now, you know, it's plain sailing and we're out of the worst. And there are too many indicators that are still suggesting there are some very wobbly times ahead. And that's why I'm suggesting that flexibility and careful management of any investments, whatever they're in, is pretty important. And remember that things can go down as well as up. Smooth says, if the Fed is already pulling back, just watch the crash. It will be the biggest in history. Well, it will be by definition, because they've got the biggest amount at the moment, right? So we are, you know, we're talking telephone numbers in terms of the amount of debt that's out there, the amount of stimulus is out there. And of course, there's even evidence, if you look at the reverse repo sector at the moment in the US, it's looking wobbly. In other words, the Fed's having to support that sector even now. So there are some early signs of some cracks in the infrastructure. And yeah, it could be big. What else have I got? Just looking, a lot of comments. As Michael says, very scary. Yep, that's how I'm thinking about it. You know, I do still manage to sleep well at night. but, you know, the fact is, there is not many people talking about this stuff in a way that makes sense. Everybody's sort of just taking the, you know, the simple story and claiming everything's fine and the markets are fine and the world's fine. You know, there are some good things. You know, we've got the deaths down very low in Australia, and that's good. And there's signs of some of the economy beginning to come back. That's good. But these fundamental issues about the structure of the economic superstructure around the world needs to be more talked about and shared, because this is real stuff and it's important stuff, and it could fundamentally change, you know, your own wealth and everybody else's wealth, your family's wealth, based on what happens. So this is really important stuff. Okay, what else have we got? Just going down the list of chat. Okay. there's a few there that I won't put up, simply because I think this is an interesting one. How do you track corporations buying family homes? Is there a source of data? Not a very good one, other than that the FIRB publishes information with regard to international buyers of all sorts of asset classes in Australia. That's the data that shows that, in fact, the biggest buyers of assets in Australia is not China, contrary to popular belief, it's actually the US. And you know, Europe and UK is also there as well. China's up there, but it's not by far the biggest. In fact, it's come back dramatically. So the FIRB data, not very accurate. It's rather old, but that's about the best way to find it. But I also do talk to you know, real estate agents on the ground and get a sense of who's buying what. And that's quite useful, because I get a bit of a sense of whether it is you know, a corporate, but that's more sort of flaky. The data set's very, very low. AI says government banning underperforming super funds. Any thoughts? Yep. So here's the point. If everybody is actually brought up to the same level, right, which is what's going to happen, is that good or not? Well, it depends on where that level settles. It could be that what happens is we actually see a reduction rather than actually an increase in overall performance, right? I think it's really important that people take advantage to understand what their fund is. Remember also that the performance of the fund is not necessarily the same as the performance returns for you as an individual in the fund. That's because a lot of the fees are not included in the fund performance management matrix. And so it's important for you to understand what the performance of your individual portfolio is within the fund. My general view is that this is more ideological than anything else. It's more to do a battle in favour of the retail super funds against the industry funds. It's more to do with prescribing specific behaviours that the government thinks they want. I'm not very positive about these reforms, but then I'm not very positive about the superannuation system overall, because the overall fees are too high, the overall performance is actually quite low, and generally most funds don't disclose enough to make good information. Now, there are a few that do, you know, that's one of the reasons why Nucleus Wealth and I teamed up, because they've got a much more transparent model for the way that they do things, but most super funds provide very little disclosure. And I think the superficial benchmarks that they're going to use won't necessarily tell us that much. That's my own view. Could be wrong. But as I say, it's down to individuals to really take the time to understand the way that their super funds are actually working and how they're performing. And the final point about the consolidation into one fund, I think that's a good thing, because obviously people pay multiple fees if they've got multiple small accounts. And often those fees are way too high relative to the balances that they're actually attached to. So consolidating and taking the super fund with you when you move from job to job makes a lot of sense. Happy with that. But this benchmarking thing and sort of ejecting low performing funds is fraught with issues in my view. Now, Ray asks about what's your thoughts on gold and silver. Yes. Well, you know, it's quite interesting, isn't it? The old gold conundrum, right? I remember somebody saying to me the other day, gold is going to be at $2,500 by the end of June, right? Well, let me just go to that and show you that. Okay, well, it's sitting at the moment at 1,785 and has been down rather than up, right? So it touched 1,900 briefly and then has come back dramatically. The thing about gold is it's not really a very good inflation hedge unless you fundamentally see significant growth. I mean, the growth, you know, if you compare the growth of gold from 2012 to now, well, it's moved up and down a bit, but really compared with the markets has not done that well. So I'm a bit sceptical, I'm afraid. I'm even more sceptical of silver. I think there are some silver merchants out there literally trying to flog silver. A lot of it, of course, is not even fully owned. So this sort of marginal lending thing that's going on both in gold and silver. So you've got to be really careful with those markets. And the real story that I have is that these precious metals are highly manipulated. They are very much under the control of the major investment banks, who have all sort of hedges around them, and they're used to manipulate and control the markets. So they're not full, open and transparent, and I don't think they're very good hedges personally. What else have we got? Taz asks an interesting question. How can central banks control inflation if it's not transitory without raising interest rates? Right. So it's about where growth comes from, right? So if you can actually generate growth without massive amounts of inflation, then there's a chance that you can actually drive it forward. But generally, the only lever that they pull is the interest rate lever. Now, if the interest rate lever goes up, does it necessarily translate into inflation? Well, it might. It might not. Depends on what happens to the debt pools that are actually being driven off it. So I don't think that increasing interest rates is necessarily directly inflationary. But we'll see. Steve Van Meter says 1,200 to 1,300 most by volumes. Yeah, well, you know, I certainly think that it's not going to be $2,500 to $3,000, or even more, like Peter Schiff and some of the other people have been talking about. I just don't see it. But then I guess the point is, what do you anchor value on, right? Is the point of value the US dollar and then things move off that? Or is it gold and the US dollar move? Yeah. So if you start from the assumption that gold is the cornerstone, right, which some people do, and everything else moves around that, you get one set of answers. If you take the US dollar as the linchpin, as it were, you get a different set of movements. And if you use Bitcoin as another linchpin, you get another set of movements again. So, you know, it's a matter of where you start the conversation from. Okay, if not gold and silver, what would be a good hedge? Well, what are you trying to hedge against is the question, right? So inflation essentially means that we're going to see prices rise. Now, there are some groups of stocks that actually perform quite well in an inflation environment. So they may be ones to think about. For example, we know that some of the utility companies, right, will be able to put their prices up and will still be doing quite well. So they would be an example of the sort of investment that you might want to turn to if you actually want to try and deal with some inflationary pressures. So stuff that you have to go on paying for regardless, right? In other words, there's a thing that the economists call the elasticity of demand, right? So there are some things that will be highly elastic and there'll be some things that won't. And you need power, you need water, you need electricity, right? So those are the sorts of things that you probably, you know, won't want to cut down on. Whereas maybe other things like, you know, your Netflix subscription, you might say, well, perhaps I'll just have one subscription rather than three. So, you know, that's an illustration of how you think about it. David asks, why do you know my question but answer the other? I don't know. Haven't done it deliberately, David. Did you put at what the world? And if you did, I'll try and find your question or ask it again. I'm not trying to ignore you, honestly. AI says, gold and silver, I never did like the shiny things. I'm just a simple guy. Right. David, what was your question? When is the new gardening with DFA Edwin Australia show going live? Says Yogi Bear. Thanks for the contribution. Good question. I'm up for it if he's growing carrots, right? I've told him, you notice I've told him you've got to put the carrot seeds in the right way up. I don't know whether he's looked at carrot seeds. You know how small they are? You've got no chance. But we'll see. You know, we might do a one from the plot later in the year. We'll see. Okay. Tran says, where do you think we are in the 18-year property cycle? And the answer is, I think we're quite close to the end of it. Maybe a couple of years, maybe slightly less. Cookie Boy says, LeCantro says stagflation is coming. I think his case is looking pretty good. Yeah, I think there's a lot of a lot of merit in that point of view. As I've explained, I've got the view that some things will definitely get crushed in the process. Don't see my wages. I don't see wages growing, and therefore costs are going up and wages aren't. That sounds like stagflation to me. Well, David, I can't find your question, so I don't know when you asked it. So ask it again, and I'll try and pick it up. What else have I got here? Dylan says, I'm long on companies like TRMB Infrastructures. Yeah, infrastructure is actually, I think, a reasonable, we have some exposure to those sorts of companies. Look, anything that basically you know is going to be required, come hell or high water, right? That's basically the way I think about it. David, I haven't. I don't see it. I don't see it. So I don't understand why I'm not seeing it. Hang on. Let me just go there. Does that change it? Okay. Trying to see it, David. I see that one. But I don't see the question that you ask. So I don't know. Have you asked a question? Okay, Ben asked, where to invest to protect your wealth given what's coming? Well, there's no simple answers to this, right? Everything has a risk attached to it. Generally, my own view has been to be flexible, to bear in mind that there are going to be significant disruptions in most of the asset classes from property through. Over the medium to long term, you know, the stock markets still do perform quite well. Even if they come back, they tend to, come up again. And, of course, there are some significant opportunities with regard to the inflation that runs through, which means that their stock prices tend to rise. So I think it's good to have a portfolio of core stocks as part of it. My own view is, and this is just me, I'm holding money out at the moment in terms of term deposits and things, waiting for the correction. I went into the market a year plus ago in March, April, when they dropped, and that was an opportunity. Didn't do much with the crypto cycle because I wasn't convinced that I could read it. Gold and silver doesn't tend to be that attractive for me, but others will actually have a very different view. But, as I've said before, you need a kernel of core investments. And then if you want to have some stuff around the edge, a bit of Bitcoin, what have you, not a bad thing to do. But don't put all your eggs in one basket. Don't put all your eggs in a property basket either, in my view. Okay. Dave, I'm looking for your question. I still can't see it. Bondi Steve says, best investment hedge in Australia, classic cars. Yep. Well, there's a lot of people buying art, classic cars, and some of those unique digitally signed assets. Who knows? Juba says, do a gardening edition. Yeah, okay. Mars says, should one put super into cash before the market crash? Well, there's an argument to say that, the valuers are pretty strong at the moment because of where the markets are. And so to lock in some of that may make some sense. Now, I don't give financial advice, so you've got to figure it out for yourself. But the trick is to know when to do that and then hold it and then hold your nerve if the market's got up a bit further. The point I should make is it's very, very hard to pick the top. And it's also hard to pick the bottom. So where we are, the chances are that the upside is much lower than the downside from where we are, because the chances of markets going much higher from where they are, I think, is relatively limited. So what that means is you want to be more conservative now than you were, 18 months ago, back in March or whenever it was, a year plus ago, when things were really down in the bottom. There, the most opportunity was upside rather than downside. It's the other way today. So that's the way I think about it. But people have different methods. And, not everybody necessarily has the same approaches as I do. But that's how I think about it. David found it. Can you please do a show with Professor Hugh White? I've been asking you for about a year. It takes two to cantango, right? I have actually contacted the professor a couple of times. Didn't get a response. So not sure I can do more than that. If you've got a way of contacting him, feel free to try and put him in touch. I'm very happy. I'm happy to talk with pretty much anybody that I can find, even if they have a different opinion, because it's all about sharing views and opinions. And I realise that it's now 9:30. One last question. What happens to house prices in stagflation? The answer is prices tend to go down because people can't afford to pay more. Thank you very much for that, smooth operator. Appreciate the super chat there. Thank you for that. And for that one too, thank you so much. And what's that one? Thank you very much. Appreciate the super chats. It really is very gratifying to see people actually find this of value. Well, considering that I didn't have Tony on the show tonight, I think we did reasonably well. We did seem to have hit the buffers in terms of timing. So I'm just going to go back to my presentation. And I might just touch the last couple of slides and then take any final questions before we go. That was what I did last time. For those interested in investing, there is the What the World Fund, which with Nucleus Wealth. Go across to whattheworld.com.au if you want more information on that, both in superannuation and outside superannuation. And it's, I think, an interesting time to explore that. Go to the DFA blog if you want more information. All my posts are there. There's the information about the blog. And, of course, you can support our work via Patreon at various levels. And if you want to get the information with regard to mortgage stress, there is actually the stress series, which is available there. You can go across to Patreon. The link is at the bottom there. And I also do... get some support from PayPal if you'd like to make a direct contribution to help us. There's the link there to do that. Or indeed, you can even use a QR code to send me some Bitcoin if you fancy that. And there's a bit of merch on the channel as well. And next time, I've got Damien Klassen on, who will also be talking about investing today, and that's on the 29th of June at 8 p.m. Sydney time. And Damien, of course, will be chatting about his theories with regard to inflation, deflation. And, of course, we'll also be thinking about some of the market developments between this week and next week. There will be more. It's just one of those things. It's such a dynamic, fast-moving environment. So mark your diary for that. And just seeing whether there are anything else. Thank you very much for... Whoops, let's push that one there. There. Thank you very much, Master Singleton. Yep. Nicholas says, what about the chat with David Icke? Yeah, yeah, maybe it's on the list. TB says, great presentation. Thanks for that. Crypto says, thanks for your input. Bondi Steve says, just remember, kiddies, people are still buying off the plan of higher. I know, isn't it crazy, crazy time? Really, really, really weird time to be doing it. Thumbs up from Edited 3 months ago. Lovely name for a, for a handle there. Thank you very much. Thank you. When's Tony coming on? Hopefully, I'll be able to get him on next month. But his personal situation with his family is a bit complicated at the moment. I won't go into detail. That's for him to share if he wants. But I have said to him, as soon as he's ready, willing, and able, I'd love to have him on and be able to touch some of the other things. And Cookie Boy, wow, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And Jason says, cheers. Very good. I'm holding on smooth. I'm holding on. Time to say goodbye from me. And there we go. Thanks very much to everybody. So thank you very much for spending some time with me this evening. Have appreciated it. Enjoyed the conversation. And I'll see you this time next week. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics signing off. Cheerio.